California counties need to have their certified election results into the state today. And this includes results from 7 congressional seats that flipped. Keys to the House podcast producer Sally Schilling helps us understand the term ballot harvesting. A new program to help homeless youth in Sacramento will kick off Monday. We'll hear from the executive director of Hope Cooperative about the innovative housing and jobs program called Possibilities. And construction is underway on a new kitchen designed to produce ready-made take-home meals that are affordable for those who struggle. It's called Fresher Sacramento, and we'll speak with Rabbi David Azen about how it works. And Sacramento folk duo Meisner and Smith released a record paying tribute to their musical influences. We'll revisit the album Headwaters before their performance at Capitol Stage this weekend. I'm Randall White, and for Beth React this Friday, that's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak on this Friday. Today is the deadline for California counties to submit their final results from last month's midterm election. All counties with contested congressional races have already submitted their tallies, so it's finally safe to say Democrats swept all 7 congressional seats they were targeting in the state. Joining us today to discuss the impact of this is Keys to the House podcast producer and reporter Sally Schilling. And Sally, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Randall. Good to be here with you.
Yeah. So the most recent seat to flip was that held by Central Valley Republican David Valadao by Democrat TJ Cox. This surprised members of both parties, didn't it?
Yeah, this one actually was rated by Cook Political Report going into election night as likely Republican. So if it's a really close race, it's rated as a toss-up. A little further one way or the other would be lean Republican, and this one was likely Republican.
So it wasn't even close to the other
side. Yeah, we were not thinking this one was going to flip, and then after election night saw the votes coming in and start to go for TJ Cox, and then, yeah, he pulled ahead by, I think, about 6 percentage points in the end, so... Yeah, and both parties definitely were not expecting this one.
And we have a clip from the podcast, Keys to the House, that addresses this.
Yeah, so we talked in our final episode that's up now about with 2 of our regular guests, political data analyst Paul Mitchell and Republican political consultant Mike Madrid. And yeah, we talked about why this, you know, what they thought of that race. So here's Paul Mitchell.
Generally, what we do see is with these late ballots that tend to be more Democratic leaning in the votes, we usually see Democrats gaining about 2 points. And in this race, the Democrat actually gained 6 points, which was, you know, about 3 times more than we would have expected. And part of it has to do with just the fact that there were so many more late ballots in all of these races, particularly in these districts where they had huge field organization and huge, you know, ground campaigns to get these late voters to, you know, take their absentee ballots, drop them off at the polling place or do provisional ballots or make sure they mail them by election day and could be counted in those days after the election.
And so, Paul, you didn't see it coming. Mike, did you?
Did not see it coming. And to me, the Valadao state's really kind of the most fascinating seat of all of these. And we talked about this a little bit previously in the series. The Valadao seat really does meet all of the criteria of being really kind of one of those red districts where the whole country is either blue becoming bluer or red becoming redder. And here there's, while there's a significant and sizable Latino community, and that's always what has been the kind of the tantalizing shiny object for Democrats looking at this seat and always falling not just short but far short of expectations to get this. The reason really is because a lot of these areas that are rural are white, have a strong white conservative constituency, and voted, you know, and vote rather conservatively, seem to be getting redder. At least in most parts of the country, they have been trending that way. And I think the fact that Valadao lost, presuming he will, and I think he will, it's just a sign of how deep what this change, this break in the Republican coalition is, which I don't think a lot of people are talking about yet.
Can Democrats rightfully claim that they're responsible for this, or did they just ride the wave?
The same Democratic consultants that are gloating right now about what a fantastic job they did are the same ones that were crying in their beer 18 months ago about what a horrible job that they did during the Hillary Clinton campaign. There are larger tectonic factors at play. And it's great that you did a wonderful GOTV operation, and it's wonderful that you knocked on each high propensity Democrat's door 150 times. The truth of the matter is this election was overwhelmingly about the rejection of Donald Trump. And I say rejection for a reason. Five of our last seven national elections have essentially been change elections. So anybody who believes that this election is somehow a mandate for the Democrats is not looking honestly at our recent history, like our last 10, 15 years. The voters of this country, and I would even argue Orange County, if you look at the data specifically, are voting in it to check the party in power. They're voting against candidates and against parties more than they are voting for them. And so congratulations to Democrats on this last Tuesday's elections in November. They were the same ones that were rejected soundly 2 years before that. And if history is a guide, if they are planning on sealing victories across the country, they're probably not going to do as well as they think they're going to.
20 seconds or less from each of you. Do Republicans have a shot at recapturing the races they lost this year in 2020? Paul.
Well, if I was a Republican consultant, the thing that would terrify me is that this impact of these elections, these seven flips, nine legislative district flips, happened in a 64% turnout election. And in the presidential election in 2020, we're going to see 78%, 75%. So take this 64% of the electorate and imagine what the next 12 to 13% add-on to that will be. It is not going to be gray-haired women from Orange County, homeowner Republicans. It's going to be younger renter minorities and college students. And so if you're to take today's election results from this election cycle and make it, 12, 15% more progressive, then I don't think you can win back these seats. Another added element to this is the timeline. The filing deadline for these seats is going to be December 6, 2019. These campaigns have a year to ramp up as opposed to a couple years. And we're going to have absentee ballots.
California has an earlier primary because the presidential race, they moved
compressed.
The primary up to March.
So we're going to have absentee ballots dropping in 14 months, and we don't even know which Republicans would be running for any of these seats, if people are going to be running for their old seats, or they're going to start recruiting new candidates, if they're going to have active primaries. They're very much behind the eight ball because of the time that they have until the next election being compressed.
And Mike, quickly, do Republicans have a shot at recapturing some of the seats they lost in 2020?
There's always a shot. I think it's highly unlikely. You're probably looking at maybe one or two seats. But the bigger point is this, which we're missing, is we're talking about Republicans trying to recapture seats in Orange County. Okay? I mean, that to tell you how significantly, to Paul's point, demographically things have changed and are continuing to change. We've kind of demographically hit that point where we're seeing exponential growth of these non-traditional, which are now traditional communities in California. Extremely hard to see how Republicans get back into relevance in the next generation, probably too, in California.
And that's Republican political consultant Mike Madrid. You also heard from Paul Mitchell with Political Data, Inc. And conducting the interview there on Keys to the House is Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. We are with Sally Schilling, a producer and reporter for Keys, or the producer and reporter for Keys to the House podcast. She's joining us with perspective on the November election, which will be certified by the state of California now that the counties are sending in their certified results. The deadline is today, right, Sally?
Correct.
So Kristen Olson, the former Republican leader in the Assembly, California Assembly, who is now a member of the Stanislaus County Board of Supervisors, said in the New York Times that this election was, quote, a major setback for the Republican Party, so much so that she doesn't think it's salvageable at this time. I mean, that really is a lot.
Right. So, yeah, and you heard Mike Madrid talking about this, too, that, the Republican Party at this point needs to take stock and reflect at who they're speaking to. This is the smallest congressional delegation that the state has sent, a Republican congressional delegation that the state has sent in over 50 years. So Mike Madrid's been kind of ringing this bell for a long time, but hearing, other Republicans having that same kind of sentiment right now is pretty interesting.
Sally, we are hearing a term a lot in recent days. It's called ballot harvesting. Speaker Paul Ryan said it this week in reference to California's election. Help us understand what ballot harvesting is.
Yeah, it's a law that was passed in 2016 in California. Other states have it as well. Previously, only if you had a vote by mail ballot that you couldn't turn in for some reason, transportation, or there was some issue getting to a place to mail it, you could have a family member or someone, a roommate or someone living with you, turn in that ballot for you. And then in 2016, California passed a law saying anyone can take your vote by mail ballot, turn that in for you. So even political campaigners could come take that for you. Republicans in recent days, like Paul Ryan, have been pointing to this law saying, and calling it ballot harvesting.
Yeah, that's a newer term, right?
Right. And in Keys to the House, we kind of talked about maybe that's kind of a charged right term to use. The LA Times editorial board came out with an editorial this morning saying, pointing to that term and saying, actually, this really is just a ballot collection process. So anyways, Republicans are saying, calling it ballot harvesting and pointing fingers at this, that did Democrats abuse this new voting law to get votes in some way? And we talked to Paul Mitchell and Mike Madrid about this as well, and whether there really was any potential for fraud in using this new system.
Well, look, if the question is, are there opportunities for fraud? Of course there are. I mean, that's undeniable. Is it happening? I don't think so. I don't think, and certainly not in any meaningful way. I think that this is another reform that is trying to accommodate the social changes in people's lives and engage as many voters as possible. And I think that's a good thing. I don't think it's anything to be feared. I do think, though, that there is something a little bit problematic about the way our civic engagement, civic involvement is changing. And I don't believe that we should be having everybody go to the polls on, you know, on the first Tuesday of whatever month it is that we're deciding to have our elections. And I'm also really not concerned about what the tactical outcomes of this are going to be. And what I mean by that is, as I have been come under a lot of criticism since the election, saying the Republican Party is basically dead in the state.
You're one of several prominent Republicans in California who are saying that, including some current and former state lawmakers.
Yeah. And there's been a really strong pushback to that from both sides of the aisle. But I think those people don't understand what's happening, the size and scope of what is happening socially here. I don't believe that ballot harvesting was an attempt to accommodate partisan gain, or if it was, I don't think that will be the long-term effects of what is going on. I think that it's simply going to be a way to get and engage more voters into the process. So while I think that we need to be vigilant in ensuring the integrity of our ballots, I think it's equally important that we work to ensure the greatest participation possible.
They're calling it ballot harvesting. It really is just about ballot delivery. Like Mike said, it is being claimed that it's to the advantage of Democrats right now. But in the long term, I don't think it's going to be to either party's tactical advantage, because both parties will start accommodating this. The first instances of how this was being done was in special elections in 2007, particularly in the 34th congressional district race, where one of the candidates was having voters come to church and drop off their ballots at church so that they could be turned in. And that doesn't seem to me to be some kind of a nefarious practice. It seems to me to be a way to accommodate more voters in this new system we're having, where more people are voting by mail. And we want to try to reduce the hurdles for people to be able to get their ballots back in.
And I'm here with Sally Schilling, the producer and reporter for Keys to the House. Sally, just before we heard that Keys clip, we mentioned that House Speaker Paul Ryan referenced ballot harvesting, and California's Secretary of State responded to that.
Yeah, after Paul Ryan said, you know, California's system defies logic, Secretary of State Alex Padilla came out with a statement saying, you know, we're just ensuring California's voting laws are carried out and protecting voting rights, and it shouldn't defy logic that elections officials are really meticulously counting every ballot.
And it takes a while to do that. This has been, people have commented on the length of time it's taken this election to get the certified results.
Right. And to have all these ballots come in on election night and then have to go back and do some verification to accommodate these new laws, it takes time. And yeah, California certainly does take a lot more time than other states, and that's why.
That's our Sally Schilling. Cap Radio's Sally Schilling, the final episode of Keys to the House podcast, is available now. You can get it at capradio.org/keys, right? Or, we always say this, wherever you find your podcasts, right? Sally, thank you so much for being on Insight and updating us on all of that.
Thanks, Randall.
Appreciate it. And we do have more information on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Here where you are standing, the dinosaurs did a dance. The Indians told a story, now it has come to pass. The Indians had...
You are listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. A new program designed to help homeless youth, specifically teens who can benefit from learning job skills, for instance, will start in Sacramento Monday. It's called Possibilities, and it'll be run by Hope Cooperative, a major provider of mental health and housing services in Sacramento. The organization's executive director, Aaron Johansson, joins us now to explain how this program will work. And welcome back to Insight.
Good morning.
Aaron, we had you on just last week, of course, to talk about the Stand Up Sacramento event, which you said was very successful.
Very successful. Yes, we raised over $100,000 at that event.
Is that right?
Yes, it was fabulous. Really exciting.
And lots of good belly laughs, I imagine.
Yes. So fun.
Yeah. Stand Up Sacramento, for those of you that don't know, is a comedy show benefiting the cooperative. But that short time ago, a week and a half now, the organization was known as Transforming Lives, Cultivating Success, or TLCS. Tell us about the name change.
So we've been TLCS since 1981, or some version of that. You know, we were Transitional Housing and Community Support for a while, and then we were just the initials for the last about 8 years. And everywhere I go, I get asked the question, what does TLCS stand for?
Right.
And what we did at Stand Up Sacramento is finally answer that question. It stands for hope. And so we are now Hope Cooperative. And that came about as a whole rebranding effort, and we just revealed it in a surprise at the event, so which hence why we didn't talk about it last week.
Yeah.
But what was so fun and exciting is Mayor Steinberg, he just rolled with that just that quick. We gave him no advance warning. We revealed the name. He came up to do his speech, and he said, well, it would have been nice for a little notice, but okay. He completely changed his whole speech to be Hope Cooperative through the rest of the thing, and it went amazingly well. So the name, it really relates to just what we bring to every service that we give and our ability to collaborate with just about everyone in the community, and that's Possibilities is a great example of that.
And it's just easier for everyone to remember and make more of a connection.
Yes,
of course,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So factors affecting youth homelessness.
Yes.
And help us understand what you mean by youth there.
Okay, so we're focusing on what is known as transition age youth. That's the 18 to 25 year olds.
Okay.
And they're those folks who are experiencing homelessness and currently living on the streets in Sacramento. And there's upwards of 300 to 400 of those young people every night. So it's a pretty big problem here in Sacramento. And the major provider of those services has been Wind Youth Services. And a couple of years ago, Susie Dodson, the former executive director, and I were on the Cap to Cap trip. That is the Metro Chamber trip to Washington, D.C.
To speak with lawmakers about what's needed and such.
Yes, advocating for the Sacramento region in Washington, D.C. And we heard about this new program type that HUD was going to be launching, which is called, it's it's a mouthful, transition to rapid rehousing for transition age youth.
Yeah.
And the reason for it is that rapid rehousing, which is basically just rental assistance, you help someone pay their rent for a short period of time and then peace be with you, you're on your own, was not working with youth because they didn't have job skills or any kind of training. So HUD recognized that it was not working and they launched this new program. So the way that it will work is that our program, Hope Cooperative, will run the transitional housing portion of the program. And during that time, 6 months, 15 youth at a time, so 30 in a year, will be part of a cohort that will have very intensive services to help them get connected to jobs and education that can give them a living wage at the end. The whole goal is prevention to the services that we offer every day. So a lifetime of poverty is not a solution for a young person. So we will be offering our services in sort of the swing shift evening, and we'll be connecting these young people with the WIND Youth Services during the day and making as many employment partnerships as we can find out there. So really what I hope listeners will hear today is that we need partnerships with employers so that we can get people connected. And we have a couple already that Woodlake Tavern, Deneb Williams, has agreed to work with us and employ some of our folks and help them get into the restaurant business from the ground up. So that's a very cool opportunity. We're hoping to work with the Association of General Contractors on some apprenticeship programs and a variety of others.
Help us understand the backgrounds of some of these young adults. Do they come from a childhood of homelessness, or are these situations where they were, you know, kicked out of the house at 18 for one reason or another?
I think it's all the gamut. I mean, there will be aged out foster youth, of course, as part of the group. Heavily, the group skews demographically heavily LGBTQ youth that are struggling, have had trouble at home. Substance use disorders will be prevalent amongst the population we will serve. It is a low barrier opportunity. You do not have to be clean and sober when you arrive, but we will be offering services and engaging with folks to help them understand that some of their behaviors do get in the way of them being able to support themselves, and we're going to work towards solving that.
How about youth that are coupled or have pets?
So pets is something that we sort of deal with on a case by case, but we will not say no to that specifically. Well, it really is, all the rules are around what works for the community. And so this community will be 4 3-bedroom townhomes is where they'll be living. And so if every single person has a pet, that's going to be a lot of pets. If someone is allergic and someone has a pet, that's a problem, just like it is in the real world. So we will be working on all of those things. How do you navigate that in your life? And that's, I think, part of the model is just what does a person find when they go to college and they live in a dorm? How do you navigate all of the challenges that you have? How do you roommate match? How do you find someone you're compatible to live with when you exit the transitional housing and go into an apartment? Because no one's going into an apartment by themselves and paying Sacramento rent at the end of this. They will be getting matched up with roommates, and they will have to live with that scenario for a while, like most people do.
What are some of the unique challenges that Hope Cooperative faces working with this age set?
So I think that part of it is when people find themselves homeless in their young years, they probably didn't get a very good start towards their life. So they probably didn't graduate from high school. Not a lot of direction about what their hopes and dreams are. Probably didn't start college, or if they did, they didn't get very far. So there's just a lot of I don't know what to do with myself. Is that, you know, which is typical of transition age youth. All transition age youth. So we're going to approach it as, you know, you didn't do anything wrong. You're developmentally right where you're supposed to be. And we're going to try to take you to the next level in a very intensive, short, accelerated fashion, which is a total of 2 years.
Your organization deals with a lot of mental health services.
Correct. Yes.
Do the youth need to need to be in that category in order to take advantage of these housing services?
No, and I'm really glad you asked that because it is a little of a departure from our normal services. But what we believe to be true and we know it to be true is the trauma that people experience while being on the streets leads to exacerbated mental health symptoms. So we are really hoping that by offering this early, that we can actually prevent a person from being a lifetime of disability and subsidized housing and all of the things that comes with a serious diagnosis. My staff at Hope Cooperative is 60% identifies as people with lived experience, mental health challenges, and they're fully employed, supporting themselves, living in the community. So we know it can be done. And so if we do encounter some of the folks in this program will have those challenges, we're really good at connecting them with the services they need while also helping them be successful in the community just like the rest of us.
There is also a lot of data out there that shows that this sort of early intervention saves money down the road for cities, et cetera.
Absolutely true. If you think about the numbers are staggering when people say the cost of untreated homelessness and untreated mental health is, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars per person can be with, you know, emergency room visits and law enforcement and whatnot. And if we can actually stop that cycle in those early years, you can't even measure the amount of money you've saved because now that person's not only not causing all of that grief to the community, but they're paying taxes and they're having families and they're connecting with each other. And that's what it's all about for all of us is connection.
All right. We're speaking with Aaron Johansson, the executive director of Hope Collective.
Cooperative,
formerly known as?
TLCS.
TLCS. They're launching a new jobs and housing program for homeless youth starting next week. As we know, housing is a major problem throughout California and here in the Sacramento region, the Reno region as well. Mm-hmm. Housing's expensive. So how does Hope Cooperative pull this off?
So that's a great question. I mean, first of all, we were able to get this property through collaborations and support from the community. So a former nonprofit called Clean and Sober was winding up their mission, and they had this property that they made available to us extremely cheap. And we were able to get a significant donation from Sutter and a bunch of other partners to rehab it, make it beautiful. And so that property is fully there, and the operations are being supported by HUD. After they leave that at the transitional phase, and they're going to be going into the marketplace with everyone else, of course. So we're partnering with Wind. They will continue to get subsidy from HUD for the next year and a half while out there in the community. But that's again why I really stress the whole roommate thing, because you know, with what we have now, the vacancy rate and the expense of an apartment, people are going to have to pair up in order to be successful. It's just the reality, and we are setting that expectation early and reinforcing it along the way, as well as the jobs piece.
We've all had bad roommate situations.
And, yes, we have.
And at that age, sometimes we're forced into dorm style living.
Yes.
When we go to college, and that doesn't always work out so well. How are you going to deal with situations where you really have two people where it becomes a dangerous situation?
Yes. And that's all part of the case management that goes along with the rapid rehousing subsidy that Wind will be providing once they leave the Hope Cooperative possibilities piece. And we make those changes. That's what we do. We're all, you know, involved up until the very end. And when it's not working, we will make a switch and make sure that we stay involved with people. When it's not as serious as you're describing, it's just the things we've all been through, then that's when the conflict resolution and how to live with people and
life learning skills
uh-huh. really comes into play. And I would venture that 90% of the time, that's the key.
Okay. Quickly, Aaron, tell us about Monday's event.
Okay. So we'll be doing a ribbon cutting 9:00 in the morning at the property. It's 2980 Del Paso Boulevard. The mayor will be speaking. We'll have some speakers from Sacramento Steps Forward, from Wind. And we're just going to celebrate the excitement we have around this. We're already almost full. We'll be full by next week with our first 15.
Aaron, it's really great to see you again. And your three cups of coffee are rubbing off on me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Erin Johansson, she's the executive director of Hope Cooperative. And we have more on our website, as always, at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station right here, Cap Radio. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak on this Friday. A new service is coming to Sacramento. It's designed to provide fully cooked take-home meals for those who can't always afford the food they need, but it's also available for those who can. In fact, that aspect actually helps fund the kitchen. Rabbi David Azen is the founder and CEO of Fresher Sacramento and joins us now with more details. And welcome to Insight, Rabbi.
Thanks, Randall. Nice to be here.
Happy Hanukkah. We're in the middle of it, right?
Happy Hanukkah to you, too, and everybody else out there.
Help us understand how Fresher Sacramento works. It's a very unique program. I've discussed a lot of different programs along this line, and I've never heard anything like this.
So apparently we have the first in the country authorization to accept EBT or food stamps for ready-made meals that can be distributed out in the community. So we make it more convenient to get delicious, nutritious, and affordable, healthy, prepared meals. As you said, for those who don't have the time, skills, or resources to do that on a regular basis. And this whole thing started with the idea that if youth were actually selling fresh produce, they'd be more likely to eat it. Right. And then almost 13 years later, I started to realize that we needed to be able to jumpstart healthy eating in an easier way. And so the real headline here is that after 3 years, we're now reopening the kitchen at the pool at the Pinnell Center in Meadowview, which is actually a terrific neighborhood.
South Sacramento.
South Sacramento, District 8. Larry Carr, the council member, has been terrific, and all of his staff. And I want to make sure to note that it actually has the second or third lowest crime rate of the 8 districts in the city. The city has invested $215 million into the neighborhood, including helping us to restore the kitchen. And so the Pinnell Center, the pool, it's a fabulous location. And we're really excited because it'll be the first time that we have a kitchen to really develop a community kitchen, a community-owned and operated a way to feed the neighborhood.
How did you locate that resource?
You know, I can't remember who introduced me to it. I was casting about for kitchens that might be underutilized or resources that we could use. And I wish I could remember who pointed it out. But it was exactly December 3 years ago that I started on this quest with the council member to get this thing up and running again.
Go ahead.
No, and so the contractor's in there. We'll have the keys, and in January we'll have access to this beautiful, awesome resource.
Oh, so the timeline, January.
Yes.
That's soon.
It's very soon.
So we always talk about and are very proud of the fact that Sacramento is the farm-to-fork capital, right?
Absolutely.
These meals that will be produced will incorporate that?
Yes, absolutely. We have been I've been connecting with all sorts of folks, from Michael Harris with Black Farmers to Soilborne Farm, anybody and everybody that we can actually source from. And we also work with Yisrael Urban Farm. And so we're hoping that the whole movement of urban ag, and then actually now that home cooks can actually produce meals, right, to really integrate everybody into a kind of a singular system. One of the things that we really think we can now look at is a community meal plan. So you go to college, you buy into a meal plan, you're set. Why couldn't a community do the same thing for itself, right? So it's a long road to hoe, but we think that there's a possibility that once folks in the community understand that we can aggregate our spending, and with us, because we're a nonprofit food cooperative, we can actually take that the food stamp or EBT money ahead of time, put it together, and then actually help people plan through the month. Because one of the things that really, as unfortunately happens in too many households, is running out of food mid-month, food banks there. But if somebody doesn't have the resources, again, to cook that food, then they're really stuck for good nutrition. And then they're heading off into all sorts of other directions that are causing the obesity and the hypertension, the diabetes, all that kind of thing.
And farmers markets throughout the area have been taking EBT or CalFresh for
yes.
a while now. not everybody knows how to prepare those foods. You know, some of the stuff can be just strange or daunting, you know,
right.
Even with a YouTube search. So in this case, the food will be fully prepared.
It's ready to be heated in microwavable containers.
Is it refrigerated or frozen?
We have to refrigerate it. The rules are that we can't serve hot meals except for disabled, homeless, and elderly. So we make the meals almost to the point of readiness and then cool them down, package them, and distribute them. And we are looking forward to being able to host events, barbecues, and other things at the kitchen, but also to find folks who, where they work, live, or play, might be able to have 20 or 25 orders at a time that we would then be able to drop off, right? So that's kind of the minimum amount that makes it worthwhile for us to bring it out there. And the most important thing that that I think we're looking at doing is to make sure that every pregnant nursing mother in the city and the county have the nutrition that they really need. We're doing a small pilot now with the Urban League and Black Child Legacy. We've got a number of moms who are having to drive to pick up their food where we're now distributing. We hope that we can find a way to distribute to their homes, especially as pregnancy increases and then the exhaustion of nursing. We want to make sure that we get these meals to them and make it affordable so that their babies have the best start in life.
How are you cultivating the recipes?
We've got over 50 recipes. We've had an executive chef who moved to the Bay Area, develop a whole bunch of things. Vince Jones has been working with us. He's a terrific chef. Maria Zeffo is now also developing recipes. But what I'm really interested in is actually having the youth come in. Food Literacy Center, you know, Alchemist, everybody, a lot of folks are doing a lot of different things with young people to get them engaged in cooking. I think the most important thing is to have them help develop recipes that they then go home and say, hey, we can have these on a regular basis.
So it can be used as a training facility as well.
Exactly. We definitely want to do job training and all sorts of other opportunities for training.
And so I'm very interested right now in the way that these meals are paid for.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to the EBT,
yes,
the people who can afford a meal but want to swing by and just pick up something because it's easier.
Exactly. These are terrific meals. You know, these are not poor people's meals. These are perfectly great meals. And the dignity of
everybody.
And you
used air quotes when you said poor people's. I just want people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot of people get confused that because we have this special EBT mission, that these meals are terrifically great. We've got chili, we've got lasagna, we've got, you know, there's one that I can't eat, pork tenderloin with asparagus and mashed sweet potatoes. It's just out of this world. I mean, all the meals are really, really well made, locally made, fresh, never frozen. And so folks, again, who could pay, let's say, $25 for four meals in a month, then help us for $15 sell the same meals to folks who are in severe, you know, limited income situations.
And culturally sensitive as well?
Culturally sensitive as well, absolutely.
All right. Well, we are speaking with Rabbi Azen, David Azen. He's the founder and CEO of Fresher Sacramento. It'll kick off in January, we learned, here today.
And soft launch in February, and then in March, it'll be my Fresher Bar Mitzvah. It'll be 13 years that I've been on this path, March 9th. So,
I'm going to have to swing by and check that out. It just sounds so innovative. Any other cities looking at doing this?
So I just presented in Boston, actually, at the Inner City Capital Connections conference, and there's a lot of interest for this model around the country now. So we're definitely looking for donors and sponsors who want to get behind this and help us get this kitchen open in the best possible manner.
Rabbi Azen, thank you so much for being on Insight this morning. More information, as always, can be found at capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight on this Friday here on Cap Radio.
Thank you.
You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. Sacramento folk duo Meisner and Smith released a record in May paying tribute to their musical influences, including Paul Simon, Talking Heads, Patti Griffin, and more. They perform this Sunday, December 9th, at Capitol Stage in Sacramento. Sam Meisner and Megan Smith spoke with Beth Ruyak about the inspiration behind the disc and where Sadie's song came from.
Gosh, I don't know what to say it other than it's the idea came from wanting to write a song about the friendship of two young kids, two young girls, and what that might be like. And it's also about memory and looking back. And yeah, it's kind of about a lot of things.
It's titled Sadie's Song?
Yeah, Sadie's Song, yes. And yeah. I think everybody has a Sadie in their life. So.
Yeah.
Well, here they are, live in our studio with a brand new song, Sam Meisner and Megan Smith.
It was a good day, breaking all the rules. Sadie lit the firecrackers, first to dare, and I was first to run. Crimson hair, rival in the sun. Sadie said, don't listen when they tell you that you're just a little girl. Skinned my knees, tore my new blue jeans, climbing over fences when it suited us to feel a bit more free. It was a good day, showing all them fool boys, doing all the things they said weren't for us, they just weren't meant for girls. Crooked smile, freckles cross her nose, made up constellations told me all the places we were bound to go. We'd drop in to every church in town, peeked in through the stained glass windows, tried to find the one God hung around. The sky, the banks of Lake Ontario, silver green reflected in our eyes. Made our pledge right there on the shore. We swore we'd never let them win. Stars came spilling down over our heads. Table bright and cold as steel. Sunrise, I am trying to remember. Were those dreams or real? All my words fall shy of arrival. Still, my heart
can feel. Whispering in my ear all this time. Sadie's been inside my head, whispering in my ear all this time.
That was an original song by Meisner and Smith, the premiere of a song titled Sadie's Song. So what's happening? Are you in a creative spurt? Are you writing more music, Sam?
Yeah. I'm writing some new songs, and we're starting to flesh them out a little bit. We even spent a little time in the studio doing that. Not necessarily that those are that's what's going to be on the next album, but kind of it's a fun space to be working. It very well may end up on the album, but it's great to it's sort of like a workspace and to kind of be able to listen back to what we've done and go, oh, okay, let's change this, or this is sounding really good. It's nice to do it other than just in our living room. Yeah.
Did this come out of spending so much time covering other songwriters' music? And Megan, talk about the recent album, which is covers, but of great songs and great songwriters.
Thank you. We had fun choosing the songs that we were going to put on the album. We actually did, I think, a collection of 15 songs in the studio, and then we kind of boiled that down to 8 tracks that we ended up putting on the album. And the title, Headwaters, sort of, you know, explains what we had envisioned this album to sort of represent for our listeners is a peek into where we both come from, both separately and together, musically, our backgrounds growing up with our separate parents' record collections and really enjoying listening to that music again and finding a lot of inspiration in those old songs that we love listening to. And then a couple of new ones too, like the Patty Griffin tune is a more, you know, recent song, and then also a song from the band Dr. Dog, which is a modern band that we both really love. So kind of a wide variety of influences for us that really infused us with some more inspiration for creation of our own sound. So
let's listen to the cover of that Patty Griffin song. Here are Sam Meisner and Megan Smith.
We tied our ribbons to the fire escape. They were taken by the birds who flew home to the country as the bombs rained on. Walking the block, the table talk. You could cry or die, just make pies all day.
How did you decide who was going to land on the album and whose song would just be recorded for some future project?
Boy, that was tough to decide, to narrow it down to 8 tunes. We wanted to show, part of it was wanting to show sort of the spectrum of our influences. It doesn't, you know, it's not just from one genre or one realm of music. So we tried to diversify some of it. So there's some Talking Heads. There's a Talking Heads song, and then there's...
And a Simon and Garfunkel.
And a Simon and Garfunkel song.
And Neil Young.
Exactly. Yeah. So there was a couple tunes that we knew. You know, the Paul Simon tune was one of the first ones we thought, that's got to go on there. Mm. But it was bouncing, you know, some of the newer modern bands and some of our songs that were on records that our parents had.
Do you two have that favorite song that you share, or even a line in a song?
That's funny. It's hard to choose. I think a lot of our favorite lines come from bands that we grew up with, like we said. And, you know, I'll be honest, I'm free to say this because I don't write most of our songs. Some of my favorite lines that I've ever heard come from Sam's writing. And I know that seems odd to say that because it's sort of biased, but
I don't mind.
I really appreciate poetry and songwriting and vivid imagery. Sadie's song, which we played for you this morning, is one of a good example of that. Just like we were rehearsing one night, playing Sadie's song in our living room, and I remember we got onto that one lyric, "Crooked smile, freckles cross her nose," and I just all of a sudden had this image of my best friend when I was a kid, and I hadn't thought about her in years, and this wasn't something I was thinking about. We were just rehearsing the song, and it brought back such vivid memories. And I think a good song from any songwriter who really knows what they're doing can do that for a listener, really bring them back to a place or a time, or give them hope, something that lights you up inside. So that's what we look for in covers that we do, is something that really makes that feeling happen inside us.
That's Megan Smith and Sam Meissner speaking with Beth Ryak in May. Their record Headwaters is available now. You can see them perform at Capitol Stage this Sunday at 7:00. And that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Today's engineer was Anthony Van Hook. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our theme music, composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show on Monday. Thanks for joining us.